My name is Susanna Curry, and today is August 14th, and my title is Entering the Land of Canaan, the Promised Land Within. Before we address the actual crossing of the Israelites into Canaan, we need to review their prior visit to the Jordan River at the border of the land of Canaan when they do not enter, and recall to mind the correspondences of that stage in our own process of spiritual regeneration with the Lord. From Deuteronomy 1, we read the words of Moses when the Israelites first came to the River Jordan after leaving captivity in Egypt. "See, the Lord your God has placed the land before you. Go up, take possession, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has spoken to you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Then all of you approached me and said, 'Let us send men before us that they may search out the land for us and bring back to us word of the way which we should go and the cities which we shall enter.' The thing pleased me, and I took 12 of your men, one man for each tribe. They turned and went up into the hill country and came to the valley of Eshol and spied it out." I think I hear the spies returning. Giants, walled cities, and fear. Aren't there any other spies to report? Oh, it's Joshua and Caleb. Come on up. And what did you find in the land of Canaan? Show everyone what you found. You found fruit and milk and honey. Well, what do you say? Shall we go into the land of Canaan? All right. Thank you so much for your report. And we hear further details of the spies' report from Numbers 13. "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land, which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have come in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size." From the previous lectures this week, you'll recall that the correspondence of the spies going into the land and bringing out the fruits, as well as the reports of the giants and the walled cities, corresponds to how, although we see the good that we can attain as spiritually mature adults, we fear and resist the challenges we need to face to achieve this vision of heavenly character. The spies, that last stage of childhood, is when we feel we know who we are and can imagine ourselves as adults, but we have not yet had the confusion of puberty kicking in. We can see the goodness of the promise of adulthood, the fruits of the land, and even taste them. And we instinctively know that all God has promised is good and true. But to abide in that land of milk and honey, we can also see that we have to face and conquer giants and cities. Joshua and Caleb, the two spies who encouraged the Israelites to enter the land and begin the conquest, correspond to the promptings of our higher nature. And even though Caleb and Joshua disagreed with the other spies, they go with the people into the wilderness to lead them in the struggles and to overcome the enemies and threats that the spies saw in the promised land, which are actually tendencies that the people carry within themselves. They've seen these giants and walled cities outside of themselves as we externalize the enemies in ourselves so that we can see them and go forth into battle with them. Some of the giants that they saw were self-righteousness and selfishness, deception and pride. Some of the walled cities, false ideas and rationalizations. And in their fear and their confusion, their sense of disobedience, they just wanted to all be safe, be like one another, and their sense of self-importance and cowardice overcame that leading that the Lord would guide them to victory. And the boundary, the word caution there, the boundary of the river, which can correspond to both truths that introduce and falsities of evil. It's a boundary that keeps the Israelites from entering prematurely into battles they are not ready to face. Just as Ken mentioned the other day that no one wants to go to Egypt, it appears that no one wants to go back into the wilderness, but it is the devil that we know. It is the known. And though all through the unsettling period of adolescence, it is a necessary stage for preparing for entering the land of Canaan, the promised land of heavenly character. The necessary lesson of going back into the wilderness is that the Lord is calling us to be conscious of the ways in which we need to grow, the ways in which our thoughts and feelings are something we have, not something that we are, and that we can, with the Lord's help, be developed and transformed. The Lord makes us conscious of our incompetence and sends us into the wilderness to learn and grow and get beyond these qualities. So actually, although they saw the qualities in the promised land, what they were actually having to do is go back into the wilderness and face these qualities, bring them forth in themselves, and have the desire to go into the promised land where they would actually do battle and transform them with the Lord's help. So this first step is a stage of becoming aware, becoming conscious of their incompetence, which is the stage of repentance. And this is a crossroads in a process of development from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence. We become aware of what we don't know, which then evolves into conscious competence. We know what we know. And then eventually into unconscious competence, which is regeneration, when we automatically do what is right without needing to think too much about it. And this change of heart and mind through experience is very well demonstrated in the example of learning how to ride a bicycle. The first time you see a bicycle when you're a kid, you see it and you think, whoa, that is so cool and shiny and I want to ride it. You don't even know that you don't know how to ride it. It looks like fun. So you pick it up and you try it, and you probably fall on your nose, and you realize you don't know how to ride it. So you become conscious of your incompetence. As you practice in this period of becoming conscious that you don't know, but you want to learn, this is the process of reformation. This is where the Lord holds the bicycle seat. While you're learning how to pedal and how to balance, you're conscious that you don't know a lot, but you're becoming competent, all very consciously aware of the process because you're trying so hard. And what eventually happens is, oh, I'm in the middle of a recipe, I ran out of eggs, I run outside, I get on the bike and I drive to the store. I don't think about riding the bike anymore. I'm now unconscious of my competence to ride a bike. And this is the process of regeneration. So the Lord sends the Israelites back into the wilderness to reform, to disengage themselves from all of the things that they felt held them back from going into the promised land. They had to get over their grumblings and learn to work with the commandments and see how they are to be obeyed because they are true, not to be obeyed just because I am told I have to. When we are obeying from compulsion, we are not truly heart and mind following the Lord's lead. We are doing it because we are expected to, and we do it for the wrong reasons. They're sent back into the wilderness as we are launched into adolescence with the commandments to live and to internalize. The struggles in the wilderness are to address our outer conduct and our inner intentions so that we might move into the promised land and continue our self-examination with a willingness to obey the Lord, unafraid of the obstacles that we need to face. We are called to overcome in the wilderness the natural inclination to rebel against what does not serve the selfish ego. So the Lord is calling them to receive the Ten Commandments, which have already been given in a new way, just as we have learned the commandments since childhood. But as we begin to learn them, we see them as a threat. The change of heart and mind that we need to go through before we enter into the promised land is to see the Ten Commandments as a promise. We've heard them as a threat and a restriction on behavior. Let us now hear them again as a promise of the person that we are each called to become. When we are young, we need to be told, "You shall have no other gods before me." But the promise is that once we reside in the promised land, when we make the crossing, you shall never have no other gods before me. It'll just be part of who you are. You shall not make for yourself an idol. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. You shall remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. You shall honor your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. And you shall not covet what is your neighbor's. These are the promises of the Ten Commandments that tell us what our heavenly character will be. And these things that we previously saw as threats become promises. They become transformed. We will not be selfish. We will be caring and compassionate. We won't be self-deceiving. We'll be authentic. We won't be conforming to everyone else. We'll be unique. We won't be stuck in false ideas, but we'll know the truth. We won't conform with everyone else. We'll be people of innovation. And I don't remember what I had across from openness. But we will be open and we will have nerve. We will have the courage that the Lord has promised us. So the wilderness wanderings have a deep purpose in us. They correspond to the beginning of our adolescent rejection of being cared for and told what to do by others from outside restrictions, and the beginning of learning to follow the call within to be the higher self, that deeper spiritual person that each of us perceives we can be. The 40 years, or the complete cycle, in the wilderness is an important transformation of our will to follow the Lord and our understanding of what heavenly character entails. So when the Israelites return to the banks of the Jordan, they have lost the previous generation, those who had been adults in Egypt during the Exodus, and the two who did not reject the Lord's leading are alive to make the crossing. Caleb corresponds to that within us that does follow the Lord, that is fit for heaven, the promised land. And Joshua corresponds to the spirit within us of truth fighting, willing obedience to the Lord, the desire to do good, to shun evil, and to follow truth. Joshua was the willing and obedient servant of Moses, who served Moses, the law, and the people of Israel faithfully as a leader in battle throughout the journey in the wilderness, and now he comes to bring them again to the Jordan at Moses' death, preparing the Israelites to enter the land of Canaan to fulfill God's promise to their forefathers. And as we heard in the scripture reading this morning, he commands them specifically about the word, the Ten Commandments. He says, "This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success." So their crossing of the Jordan begins by the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant, stepping boldly forward into the river, and the waters parted and stayed back as long as they remained in the midst of the channel, and the people crossed over safely. So in us, as long as the commandments are central to our thinking and our intentions, the Lord can keep the way open before us. And this marks the end of the period of reformation in us and the beginning of regeneration. Yet we need to remember that we return to make this crossing many times throughout our lives. Parts of us regenerate at different speeds, and when we have passed through this wilderness of confusion and questioning about certain aspects of ourselves, we then are prepared by the Lord to go into a period into the wilderness and back across the Jordan about something else in our intentions or our understanding. But when we hold the ark aloft as the priests did and step into the waters of introduction, which is one of the correspondences of the river, If it is our intention to face the challenges of our self-centeredness, we are entering the promised land anew. And the two charges that the Lord makes and that Joshua speaks to us, these inner promptings, are to be strong and of good courage, and to meditate on the book of the law day and night, and observe to do according to all that is written. The crossing of the Red Sea by Moses corresponds to our first decision to be good, and the crossing of the Jordan into the promised land corresponds to our recognition that we want to be good because it is the Lord's will for us. Further in the book of Joshua, it speaks to us of the final conquering of the land and the completion of the division of the land among the tribes of Israel. And we hear in that part of the story a later and lasting stage in our own regeneration. It's the actualization of the ignorance of wisdom. The most obvious evils have been identified and destroyed. The will to obey has conquered the intention and inclination towards sin. But the last tribes haven't yet gone into the land to describe it, and they don't yet know where they will live in the land of Canaan. And this is corresponds to us, inside of us, to the aspect that there is always still work to be done. There's work of discernment and settlement. Within us, there are lands in our subconscious that we have yet to enter. We have yet to describe them and decide where we live within them. For today, as in every day, as we regenerate with the Lord, there is a task at hand to better understand how the Lord is regenerating us and how we can cooperate with the process to the end of becoming better able to love God and our neighbor and to live the commandments as the promises that they are. Through our willing obedience to the Lord guides us to work and to discern where we should go, where our attention should be focused. These are our return visits to the wilderness and the crossing of the Jordan. The Lord works with each of us to show us the lessons of our individual regeneration, and the Lord's command to Joshua throughout his journey is, be strong and of good courage. The Lord knows it's a long, challenging, and difficult journey, but he gives us all the direction we need. To remind us how we can grow in wisdom and understanding, the Lord commands Joshua to meditate on the law day and night, to remain in the land of Canaan, to inhabit the land of Canaan, the heavenly character. And as always, the Lord reminds us of our free will. From Joshua 24, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served before the river, beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." So let us be mindful of the way in which the commandments are to the heavenly character a promise and not a threat, that we are constantly being called to regenerate in deeper and deeper ways, and that the caution which initially holds us back from moving into the promised land can be seen in a new way as well. It no longer holds us back, but in its positive form is there to guide our first steps in becoming inhabitants of the promised land within. That is the end of the prepared text. I would love for us to explore just a little bit, not so much question and answer wise, but popcorn style, if you have a comment. What are some of the ways that these things actually can be transformed into good things? For instance, do you find sometimes you figure out what you know by figuring out what something that you just say, that just can't be right? You actually didn't know what you believed about a certain thing until you figure out what you don't believe. That a false idea actually has a benefit in helping you clarify what is the truth. It helps you step over. That just like we don't want to necessarily go to Egypt, we don't necessarily want to be in the wilderness, but there are lessons to be learned there. Do any of these other things pop out to you as actually being helpful in learning from the negative?
Well, false idea is I thought I was the center of the universe for quite a long time in my life and finally figured out that that wasn't going to help me through the world.
Mm-hmm. So the self-centeredness, which or self-importance, actually can be a lesson in understanding the importance of other people. It helps you to get there because you realize this doesn't work. Thanks. Ken?
To be redundant, Sherlock Holmes' approach was to eliminate all possibilities mm-hmm. that weren't true, and whatever was left, no matter how improbable, that was the truth. And that's certainly the way I went about pursuing my religion.
Mm-hmm. Found all the things that weren't true, and then you found something improbable? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I guess in that I eliminated everything that I could find. I mean, I tried everything that I could find. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were good things to be learned there, but nothing. At the end, I was left with Swedenborgianism. Yeah. I mean, there was just no other choice left.
So it became authentic for you.
That's right.
And it comes from the wilderness experience to identify that.
That's exactly
yeah.
right.
David?
We need to learn humility to approach the Lord, and we don't learn it except by having the pride that goeth before the fall. Swedenborg himself was quite proud as a young mm-hmm. man, and he had to learn the hard way, as most of us do, how to not be prideful and to mm-hmm. learn humility before mm-hmm. the Lord.
On that too, there's that pride thing is such a paradoxical thing, because if we have pride in ourselves, then it's a problem. Mm-hmm. But if we have pride in the Lord and in our relationship with the Lord and what the Lord does for us, then it becomes a good thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's maybe one of our problems as a church, is that we're not proud enough of the theology that mm-hmm. we've been given. And we're always, I'm generalizing here, but we tend to be defensive and apologetic, and mm-hmm. rather than having that good feeling, that which is really a kind of takes some courage to mm-hmm. to be proud of what you have and what mm-hmm. serves you well, and the idea that maybe it could be useful to others. So we need to be as careful of false humility,
celebrating our uniqueness,
false pride,
right.
And that's such a tricky thing to deal
mm-hmm.
with.
And it's all the intention behind it. Is it because you want to puff up yourself, or you want to share what you find of wonder and beauty? George?
Now, there's a story, perhaps apocryphal, about Thomas Edison, someone visiting him in his lab when he was working on this light bulb project and seeing all the failures scattered around. He said, "Don't you ever get discouraged?" And he said, "No, these are all the things now I know don't work."
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
I think there's a fine line between there's a lot of stress now, self-esteem and mm-hmm. self-confidence and how important, but there's a fine line between that and selfishness and,
right.
Too much ego.
I think the fine line...
Have self-esteem and be an open person and still mm-hmm. Not see it as something that's...
Do you think it's a finer line with others than with ourselves, though? Do you think in ourselves we really know when we're selfish?
Well, I think there's a little danger that the stress on self-esteem, say, in the school systems, may create a sense of that self-importance is what's a good thing, yeah. Not.
So there's age-appropriate lessons about
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah.
That distinction is quite mm-hmm. close in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Dean?
I was thinking about conformity, and as a teenager, in my era, you had to have your pants just to where the black socks came, and then you had the loafers, and my mom didn't want to buy pants that would, I had outgrow, so I had these long pants and just couldn't wear them that way. So I actually went outside and hid behind a tree and pinned my pants up each day and come home with bloody ankles because the pins would be cutting me all day long.
But you look great.
But that, I, and that conformity was so important to me as a teen. I mean, and I know it is for all of us that we have to meet some standard of fashion. And then at some point, I grew out my hair and said, the heck with it. But that was when I crossed mm-hmm. it. But I had to stay there a long time mm-hmm. and suffer with those bloody ankles before I could say, right. what?
Before innovation could be something that you could feel comfortable with, that you could do something different than other people. Yeah.
Well, courage.
Courage, too. Right.
Here again, this is one of those paradoxical things, because while conformity out of fear is the bad thing, a sense of unity mm-hmm. and conjunction out of love is mm-hmm. not just a good thing, it's one of the things we're looking for, mm-hmm. a sense of community. You don't, and it's exactly this flip that it's taking something that's expressed in the negative and expressing it in the positive, and it just transforms everything. Mm-hmm. You know, to conform is, and you know, again, out of fear of being different, that's a bad thing. But to meld yourself, to fit in and be a useful part of a community out of love, mm-hmm. from the outside it might look exactly the same, but from the inside,
right.
completely different experience.
And that's why I think it's important, as Jim brought up, it's, there's age appropriateness to the lessons that we're going to learn, and that the conformity of a teenager is different than the desire to be in community of an older person. And there's maybe at the same time, I mean, that's one of the parts of the wilderness experience I think that's so confusing, is that different parts are regenerating within us at different speeds. It's not like we're going to conquer these and move right over as one unit. We go back into the wilderness all over and over and over again in our lives.
Yeah, I'm married to a woman who said at 37, I don't think I want to do this life. And she went back into the wilderness for 7 years before she wanted to cross the Jordan River over here. We do this over and over again in our lives. It's not a one-time thing. We have to go back into the wilderness at various times. And thank mm-hmm. God when we find the mm-hmm. river and it's open.
Right.
And Dean, do I hear you drawing a parallel between seminary and the wilderness?
It seemed like 40 years.
yeah. Laura?
Who was in the wilderness there?
Laura?
Thinking about what Jim said about the self-esteem issue, that to me goes on the deception or authenticity thing. That, mm-hmm. you know, if you're trying to help kids build their self-esteem and you're doing it in a deceptive way of telling them they're wonderful, they know underneath what their capabilities are, what their skills are. You can tell a child they're a great artist, but if they look at their artwork and you haven't taught them how to draw it so that they're comfortable with it and happy with it, they know there's deception there and it's not going to be true self-esteem. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of coming at that issue backwards. We're not going to feel authentic until we get the skills and the kind of character that we want to have, that then we can have a good feeling about. Mm-hmm.
Now that there's an inner journey, but also there's a communal journey with others, mm-hmm. and that's an important influence.
But that doubt is important, you know, that there is a point between self-esteem and doubt that everybody has to face and say, no, I don't doubt myself anymore. I'm going through. I have self-esteem, but we don't feel that as teens. I didn't feel it as teens. I was so clueless.
Harold?
So I have a question, maybe George or Lee or you or someone wants to address it. I have this idea of the land of flowing with milk and honey. Mm-hmm. What's that correspondence or spiritual meaning, the flowing milk and mm-hmm. honey?
Flowing is bountiful. I mean, the fact that it's there and it's continual supply. But the milk corresponds to truth with good, that has good within it, which we talk a lot about truth and good and love and wisdom. And I think the part that sometimes it's our dual minds keep forgetting the part where they're just distinguishably one. We can talk about the two parts, but they're really one thing. And that the honey corresponds to the happiness from being involved, being in, having the nurturance of the milk. But that's just definition one. More are welcome. But milk and honey having to do with us being fed by the Lord and being fed the truth that is good for us, and we are nurtured by it, and that makes us happy. The sweetness of the honey makes life a joy. Lee?
I think that honey, oddly enough, has to do more with the external satisfactions. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure about the milk. It may be a little more the internal goodness. The source would say something about that, mm-hmm. that milk comes from warm-blooded mammals,
right.
And humans, honey comes from insects.
And both are freely given. They're not killed for those products.
Well,
so they're alive. There's aliveness to the milk and the honey. Yeah. So I hope that from this, that we've got a little bit of a sense of the importance of the wilderness journey. That just because there are negative things that need to be overcome, it's we need to do that. That the going back into the wilderness isn't a bad thing. That when we have to face the evils and the sinful tendencies within us, that's not a bad thing. That we're able to see them, as Swedenborg says, we can't see and face them and deal with them until we see them outside of ourselves. So when the spies saw all those enemies over there, in a way, they were also beginning to be ready to see the enemies within that they were going to start to deal with in the wilderness period when we define ourselves by what we aren't. Ken?
I've been really struggling lately with reading the same Bible and believing in the same Jesus Christ as all the conservative Christians, and wondering how it is we have such different takes on this, and how do we bridge this gap? I mean, we have something in common, mm-hmm. but and you're putting forth the Ten Commandments as Ten Promises is the closest thing I've ever heard. I think it's just a fantastic concept that. At a certain stage in life, we hear those as commandments and disciplines, and just the way we hear the discipline our parents impose on us, and we rail against them as being mean and hate us and taking away all our freedom. And yet, those same words, those same messages can be experienced in a completely different way as promises and fulfillments of what it is we really want and what is good for us. And if we can find ways to talk about our theology as in that sense of interpreting the same things, not that they're wrong and we're right, mm-hmm. but that we are responding to these same things in a very different way, I think we have a way of bridging this gap between all of these really good-hearted and committed and sincere conservative Christians who seem to have this wall between us. My mind is just racing right now, but I think you're really onto something there with what you said about the perceiving those Ten Commandments, but then also perceiving them as Ten Promises.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. A great idea.
It has to do with how we perceive God. The God, the punishing God, is where the threats seem to be coming from. But God, the loving God, is the one who's leading us into this wonderful state of being that we can have if we follow the commandments.
If you're happy and fulfilled, you don't want to steal.
Right.
I mean, and that's what... If you're in that place, to be given the promise to be in a place where you would have no, why would I want to do that?
Right.
Well, that's the ultimate goal.
And that's the freedom, whereas we see the threats initially as restricting our freedom. in actual fact, when these promises become true within us, we're in total freedom because we have exactly what we want. Yeah. Lee?
Well, following up on what Ken is saying about the false ideas and the truth, you talk to a traditional, especially an evangelical or fundamentalist Christian, and they'll say you have to believe in Jesus to be saved. And if you don't believe in Jesus, you won't be saved. And for them, that functions as a bedrock truth, that they, if they don't believe that, they're violating their religion, and they're going to be damned to hell. And it works as long as you keep it within the orbit of Christianity, because Swedenborg says the same thing. He says, though, if you're a Christian, you must believe in the Lord's divinity. He may state it in that way, or you must believe in the Lord. And elsewhere he says, whenever I speak of the Lord, I mean the Lord God Jesus Christ. So that's true for any of us who identify ourselves as Christian. That's true for us. It is a truth, and yet if it's applied in the wrong fashion or from the wrong motives, it becomes falsity. Like, if you're a Muslim, you're going to go to hell because you don't believe in Jesus. And I'm still struggling also with this idea that truth can be either true or false depending upon how it's used.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be an example of it, that if you apply that to Christians, it's true. Christians who reject Jesus, they're rejecting their religion. Whereas non-Christians, that's not their religion. If you take that truth within mm-hmm. Christianity and apply it where it doesn't work, then it becomes a false idea.
Actually, it was a Sufi woman who gave me more insight into that phrase, believing in Jesus, because they accept the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Quran. And that she had been challenged a few times about believing in Jesus. And she said, no, I believe Jesus. But believing in, I would ask the question, what does that mean?
Well, because for them, it means that Jesus is the sole and only Son of God and the only
right.
way of salvation and divine and all sorts of things
mm-hmm.
that your Sufi woman probably doesn't believe. So if they
or believes to, those in addition to other things.
And that in
right.
itself, that disqualifies
mm-hmm.
her.
But I
from
guess
that, from there,
the question I have about, you know, where's the false idea and the truth in that? That isn't it a false idea to think believing in a certain concept is in fact not what Jesus would do, where you use it as a bludgeon for other people?
It's the motive.
Right.
Are
but
you
it's
using
it's
it to put people down, or are you using it to lift people up?
And that Jesus himself didn't say to do that to people. He said to love your neighbor as yourself. And
he also said numerous times, those who hear my words and do them,
mm-hmm.
that's what I'm after.
Right.
Not people who put me up as a little plastic idol and worship the idol.
Right.
Just live the way I lived and live my teachings. That's the way you believe in me.
Right.
And
he said other things too, though. I mean, like, I am the way and no one will come to the Father except through me. I mean,
well, to me,
right.
I interpret.
Those who don't believe are condemned already.
So that's kind of challenging.
Well, to me, that means when he says, I am the way, he says, my life and my being is the example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he says, don't worship me as something separate and removed from life. He says, if you believe in me, then live the way I've lived. You know, live out my commandments and live out what I've spent my entire life, from at least the 3 years of ministry, demonstrating. So that's what I take that to mean.
I've had a number of fundamentalist Christians in the United Ministry at Harvard trying to explain the same thing, and they had a difficulty with it. And the way I take it is the divine human is the Word made flesh, and the truth of God that's present in all religions, and if you don't take that and live it, then you're not going to have the way, you're not going to have the truth and the life. So to me, the appellation Jesus Christ is something that we know because we have the New Testament word, and so we're bound by it. But if people don't have that word, if they have a different word, or if they have a different scriptures, then they can come into that same structure. That's the way I take Swedenborg to say that the divine human, that's the the word made flesh in all religions. And if we don't have that concept, I think we're, well, it's going to sound judgmental, but I don't think we're true to our faith if we don't recognize that the people that have the other religions have the way. But it's difficult.
It's not just Swedenborg that says that. One of the passages that the fundamentals don't seem to do very much with in Paul is just before the statement about I say you're saved by faith without the works of the law. In Romans 2, the earlier part, it talks about Jews and Gentiles and how they become a law unto themselves, their conscience now convicting and now acquitting them. And so they're essentially, he's saying, they're judged according to the beliefs that they have adopted.
The beliefs that they've lived.
In the Protestant Bible.
And that brings up, you know, our own concept of the primacy of love and charity, that these are the real essence of who you are and who you will be to eternity, that the doctrine within us is going to change and grow, but that the love is what's going to remain forever. George?
Yeah, I think there's almost a prior step that's very difficult for what I conceive of as a fundamentalist mind to take, and that is to acknowledge that their reading of the scripture is their reading and take responsibility for it and admit that it is their choice and the Bible isn't telling them how to read it, so to speak.
Right.
And that's a very hard step.
Right, and there's a conformity in that belief that that we're all reading this the same way here in this church, so it must be right.
Yeah.
And we're not allowing that the Lord might inspire individuals to see something new in it.
In Swedenborg history, it's the difference between basically canonizing your derived doctrine, so to speak, and saying this is the way you have to read Swedenborg. And not realizing that other people read it differently and get some different things out of it.
And the way that it might have changed over time, this doctrine, that this truth, and I'll tell you a little story. Do you know the story about the Easter ham? The Easter ham that you have to cook with the ends cut off. It's just the way you cook the Easter ham. You put it in the pan and you cut off each end. And then finally, after many, many generations of the Easter ham being cooked the same way, someone asked one of the older ladies, why is it that we always waste those two ends of the ham? She's thinking back and thinking back. And well, you know, great, great, great grandmother, she had a pan that was a little too short. So, you know, for the next six generations, they're cutting off the ends of the ham because it didn't fit in the pan. But they didn't remember why they did it anymore. It just became the law.
And I found that evangelical Christians don't like it when you point out that certain Protestant theologians were the first one to teach that particular doctrine. They sort of assume that that's just where it is in the Bible, and they have, my experience of the ones I've spoken to, they have very little concept that these doctrines that they believe in have particular theologians who are their sources. And they taught their followers this, such as predestination or salvation by faith alone or whatever, that these actually came from particular theologians and became the doctrine of that church, and they've adopted it. They may be a few steps removed from that. They just assume that's what's in the Bible without any human intervention whatsoever. And it's very hard. I'm more or less echoing and amplifying what George is saying. It's very hard to get any concept in there that this is a human interpretation of the scriptures that they believe in.
I'd like to just put out as one last word before we stop that we have spoken quite freely about fundamentalists, but I think we also should remember that perhaps as Swedenborgians we should go into the wilderness a little bit and look at how much we're prideful and perhaps self-important about our own doctrine, and as Ken said, have a healthy sense of celebrating our uniqueness and not use our doctrine to bludgeon anyone over the head and tell them that they're wrong. I know we do it more gently than other people perhaps, but we still are at risk of using our doctrine uncharitably, and that remembering always that charity is the that charity and love is the center of God's substance, and that the doctrine and the truth are the forms in which it takes. So we are done. I would invite you to step cautiously over the caution tape, but choose to hold the commandments before you and step boldly into the land of God's promise as you go forth from this day.
Are the two spies still here?
No, the spies were excused for games. Oh, okay. But the 10 negative spies, they've been hanging out in the back all this time.